Good afternoon, Michael Malice here. Let that be your welcome for the next hour. We have with us an extremely special returning guest, Glenn Greenwald, one of the most prominent journalists of our time. His Substack is one of the most popular on earth. Glenn, thank you so much for taking the time to return to the show.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to be back. Thank you for asking me.
So the big question I wanted to ask you is, you know, I follow your Twitter very religiously, as a lot of other people do. And in recent months, it seems to me that you've become more critical of your journalistic colleagues. Is that a function of you maybe getting more ornery, or in your opinion, have they gotten more blatant with their, you know, misbehavior over the last, let's say, couple of years?
I'm not sure my journalistic colleagues, as you so politely put it, would agree that there's been ever a time in my past when I was less ornery with regard to them as I am currently. I will actually tell you a little story. When I first started writing about politics in late 2005, my intention was to cover a narrow range of issues that arose primarily out of my expertise in constitutional law. I was still a constitutional lawyer at the time and was motivated almost exclusively to write about the civil liberties assaults being waged in the name of the war on terror. So issues like Article II theories adopted by Bush and Cheney about a president's power to essentially ignore congressional restrictions on their power, the ability to detain people without charges, to spy on them without warrants, those sorts of issues, and realized very early on that there was no way to make any kind of progress entering the discourse without directly confronting the ways in which the corporate press was propagandizing people about those issues, because they have such powerful megaphones. Yep. That if all you're doing is kind of sitting on your little island, politely dissenting, no matter how convincing and persuasive your arguments are, your work is going to be inconsequential. And so directly confronting corporate media employees, forcing them to respond, figuring out ways to make them refute the critiques has always been central to my work. You know, I do think the Trump era radically changed journalism for the worse. It took a lot of their worst attributes and accelerated them to an exponential degree, because they really became convinced and are still convinced that they're waging this existential fight for everything good and decent in the world, and therefore anything goes, and there are no more journalistic constraints on what they can do. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, certainly my view of them has worsened, and so probably my critiques have become a little harsher, but I've always viewed the corporate press as one of my primary adversaries.
I, as well as you, vividly remember the Bush Cheney years, and I would like to hear your thoughts about Liz Cheney being basically, and the Cheneys and W. Bush being championed by outlets that previously, with some reason, you know, compared them to war criminals and Hitlers. I'm specifically thinking of Liz Cheney being regarded as some kind of paragon of integrity, when while her sister was a lesbian, she was against gay marriage, even though her father of an older generation, who could perhaps be excused for this, was for it. And then later she realized, oh, yeah, I'm for it all along, and kind of repaired this rift with her own sister. And now she's, you know, being regarded as some kind of, you know, holy figure. What are your thoughts on the resurrection of Liz Cheney and the Cheneys?
Yeah, I think it says a lot about the American right and then also the American left. I don't think it is fair or just to hold somebody responsible for the bad acts of a relative, of their parents, their siblings, or anything like that. So I'm not judging Liz Cheney because she's Dick Cheney's daughter and judging her by Dick Cheney's acts. I'm judging Liz Cheney by Liz Cheney's acts. And all the things that made Dick Cheney such a despised figure among not just the left, but establishment liberals. I mean, he was basically public enemy number one of everybody, you know, center left and left for essentially the decade after the 9/11 attack, was due to his, he was the principal impetus behind some of the most controversial post-World War II policies the United States has adopted, opening a due process free zone in Guantanamo, where we put people in the middle of the ocean, thousands of miles from their home, and imprison them indefinitely with no trial, declaring people unilaterally, including American citizens, enemy combatants, which meant we can imprison them, even American citizens, without trial, the invasion of Iraq and destruction of Iraq, obviously, the kidnapping program, where we would kidnap people off the streets of Western Europe and render them to some of the most brutal dictators in Syria and Egypt, to be interrogated without the ability of the Red Cross or the Human Rights Network to have access to them. All of these things that made Dick Cheney such a, you know, radical and hated figure are all things that Liz Cheney to this very day supports. If you ask her about torture, Guantanamo, rendition, due process, free detention, she will say to this very day that she believes in all of those and that it was a mistake to renounce any of them. And not only that, but during the Obama years, when her father was gone from office, her primary ally were the neocons, were people like Bill Kristol. And I remember in particular, she formed this really insidious group called Keep America Safe. And the idea of it was essentially to demonize as allies of the terrorists anyone who dissented from the neocon foreign policy and the Bush-Cheney view of the war on terror. And one thing they did in particular, where there were Justice Department lawyers working for the Holder Justice Department, who, in my view, to their credit, had done pro bono work defending Guantanamo detainees and challenging the civil liberties assaults of that was Guantanamo and arguing that they deserve at least an argument in court that they weren't actually guilty of anything and therefore were being unjustly imprisoned. And Bill Kristol and Liz Cheney produced one of the worst political ads ever called the Al-Qaeda 7, in which it insinuated that these lawyers inside the Holder Justice Department had sympathies to or were even in alliance with Osama bin Laden by virtue of that legal work that they've done. So she's been one of the most insidious figures in American political life for two decades, and solely by virtue of the fact that she denounced Donald Trump and viewed Donald Trump as an enemy, made liberals, you know, literally venerate her as a hero. Mother Jones called her their hero of 2021.
Oh my God.
I think, you know, what is very interesting about this that liberals refuse to recognize is the reason Liz Cheney hates Donald Trump is not because Liz Cheney is some, you know, stern believer in democracy. We just went through all the very anti-democratic policies she supports, nor some woman of, you know, steadfast principle. You mentioned she was willing to throw her own sister and her marriage overboard in order to get elected by abandoning her previous support for same-sex marriage to get elected in Wyoming. So she's none of those things. The reality is that Donald Trump in 2016 ran vehemently and vocally in opposition to the Bush-Cheney neocon foreign policy. And that is what turned people like Liz Cheney and the Bush family and Bill Kristol and David Frum and neocons against Donald Trump. It shows this enormous cleavage between what Trump brought into the Republican Party and what it had been in the past. And at the same time, it shows how American liberals have really become essentially close allies of the neocons, because with Russiagate, they started revering the CIA, the Pentagon, this kind of these jingoistic theories that Liz Cheney embodies. So it's not just that liberals are being hypocrites. I think in Liz Cheney, you see a lot of these really crucial transformations in the political reality.
One of the most kind of absurd things I've seen is that Bernie Sanders, who arguably can be regarded as a descendant of the Eugene McCarthy wing of the Democratic Party, the anti-war, you know, a social democrat aspect of the Democratic Party, advocating on TV, I don't remember if it was the FBI or the CIA, saying that we should trust them, where this is like, this is 101 stuff for the old hippies. Like, these guys are not good. You know, they kind of infiltrate every organization. Do you regard this with any kind of, you know, sense of humor that like it's almost become absurd to watch people you know, on MSNBC praising George W. Bush with a straight face?
I mean, who was the number one hero, the number one most revered person by American liberalism during the 4 years of the Trump presidency? It was George Bush's post 9/11 FBI director, Robert Mueller. The person who invented these very radical theories of domestic law enforcement that enabled the Justice Department to round up American Muslims with no due process by claiming that they were material witnesses to crimes, namely to 9/11. And it was Robert Mueller who went before Congress and gave his assurance as this like respected, you know, apolitical foreign policy analyst using the, you know, post J. Edgar Hoover reputation of the FBI as a clean cut straight shooter, that there really were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And to watch liberals turn him into you know, their number one hero to sing songs about him, you know, on Saturday Night Live, and to sell merchandise with his face on it, and to view him as the savior of the Republic, I think really illustrated this view of American liberals, because Russiagate was their number one religious conviction. The idea that, you know, Donald Trump was in bed with the Kremlin, that he essentially, that the Kremlin had taken over the levers of American power. This all came right out of the CIA. And for years, the people who were feeding the corporate media, the liberal wing of the corporate media, with what became the prongs of the Russiagate conspiracy were the dark deep state, the CIA, the NSA, the Justice Department, the FBI. And that's who liberals ended up in bed with. That's who, you know, if you turn on CNN or MSNBC, all you see are former CIA operatives and NSA goons and FBI agents. And this is really what American liberalism became, is this reverence for the military industrial complex. And it culminated for me with not just Bernie's embrace of Russiagate, which at first I thought was cynical, but then came to actually believe far worse that he was a true believer in it. But with the fact that, you know, Joe Biden just asked for $33 billion more to spend, quote unquote, on the war in Ukraine, which really means giving it to Raytheon, General Dynamics, and the CIA with very little accountability. And every single no vote, Michael, every single one came from the Republican Party. Not a single Democrat, not Bernie Sanders, not a member of the squad, nobody, none of them even raised any concerns about this bill, let alone voted no. And so in this, you see this radical transformation, not of my politics or of me or of Matt Taibbi or whoever people think have changed their politics, but of the Democratic Party and American liberalism.
So that's a very frequent criticism. You brought up Taibbi. That's a very frequent criticism you get as a response on Twitter, which is, well, you're not on the left at all. You're basically a closet conservative. Do you still consider yourself on the left? And what does that term mean to you?
So actually, I've always been a little bit, not a little bit, more than a little bit, resistant to embracing any of these political labels, because so often there really is no fixed meaning to them. They are used as shorthand to avoid having to think through ideas. Yeah. Just the minute you can place one of these on something, you know in advance what your answer is supposed to be. You don't have to grapple with arguments. You don't have to present evidence. I've always found them more obfuscating than illuminating. And, you know, I've always kind of been heterodox. When I released my first book in 2006 about the perils of broad executive power theories under the war on terror, the first place I presented my book at was the ACLU, and the second place I presented it at was the Cato Institute. I think the first time I ever got paid to write an article, or the first three or four times actually, was for the American Conservative, founded by Pat Buchanan and run by a bunch of paleo conservatives who like my views on surveillance and the Iraq war and executive power. So I've always purposely cultivated this kind of heterodox audience. And so I never really embraced any label other than civil libertarian. That's the only one I think really tightly fits. But the idea that, because if the political kind of dynamic around you changes and you end up, you know, talking to people 10 years ago you were only fighting with, and fighting with people who 10 years ago you were allied with, it somehow means that you've changed your political views. It might mean that, but it doesn't necessarily. And every time I hear that accusation that I've changed my political ideology, I always ask, just give me one example, like one actual concrete example of a view I used to espouse that I now repudiate, or a view that I used to reject that I now advocate. There is none. You know, I'm not saying my views haven't evolved on certain issues. I hope all of our views are always evolving as we, you know, gain more experience and gain more understanding of ourselves and the world around us. But I haven't had any major transformation. It's just that the way the Democratic Party is situated and the way it's composed, that is what has changed. And I think Trump changed the Republican Party and the American right as well.
One of the things I'm proudest of in terms of my work and I'm just amazed to what extent it's happened, is getting conservatives to be more skeptical of both the police themselves and how police use their powers. This is something I would have been considered, you know, unthinkable 5 years ago. To be a conservative was effectively synonymous with advocating for the police and making excuses for them. Are you, you know, in the same way that maybe you're surprised by some of these stances that people who are the Democratic Party or the broader left, whatever sense you want to use that term, have taken? Are you surprised to watch conservatives becoming, you know, much more skeptical at the very least of the police?
Yeah, I mean, I think the police, you know, specifically and kind of the use of police power in general, you know, there was always a kind of, I guess we can call it like a libertarian strain on the American right. I always found very healthy when, for example, Janet Reno sent in the feds to Waco and, you know, killed Randy Weaver's wife and Ruby Ridge and, you know, those kinds of executive power overreaches. There was a lot of common ground that the kind of libertarian right and parts of the anti-authoritarian American left were able to find. I mean, Gore Vidal wrote an incredibly interesting article. I don't know if you ever read it, in Vanity Fair, when he became one of Timothy McVeigh's closest confidants, as Timothy McVeigh was arrested for that Oklahoma City attack. And he began exploring, Gore Vidal did, you know, a long time, classic leftist from related to the Kennedy family, this idea that a lot of what was motivating the American right in the Clinton years was a skepticism of federal law enforcement and its corrupting nature that was very similar in nature to what the anti-authoritarian left was motivated by in terms of their view of the CIA and the FBI and all that, you know, second half of the 20th century activism that came out of the American left. I think it has intensified greatly because conservatives saw how pernicious the CIA can actually be, or the FBI can actually be, with its interference in the 2016 election. That was the real interference in the 2016 election, and as well as in subverting the Trump presidency. But I also think that once a political movement starts questioning authority in general, it leads to skepticism toward authority in every instance, including the police, including the U.S. security state, including the U.S. war machine. And I just feel like if you want to question establishment power or ruling class orthodoxies, bizarrely, you now have more space to do that in right-wing circles than you do in left-wing circles.
Let's get back to the show. A person can criticize colleges, the media, the newspapers, Republicans, Democrats, you know, the military, activists. The only agency where if you criticize them, you are called crazy immediately is the CIA. Can you explain to people hearing this, like, why is that inaccurate to say that, well, if you criticize the CIA, you just got to get a tinfoil hat and you're a lunatic?
Well, so I'll just give you, you know, a very kind of physically proximate experience. I, as you know, live in Brazil. I'm speaking to you from Brazil. In 1964, Brazil had not a communist government, but just kind of a center-left government, democratically elected. And Brazil was steadfastly neutral in the Cold War. They always tried to maintain exact equidistance between Moscow and Washington so they didn't end up in one orbit or the other. And they were this flourishing democracy, setting an example for the region. And the Kennedy administration and then the Johnson administration began viewing the center-left government is going a little too far to the left. They didn't like some of their rent control proposals. They didn't like some of their support for labor unions. And they started telling the Brazilian government, look, we think you're going too far left. I mean, this is the kind, this is why I always found it so hilarious that American liberals talked about Russian interference in our democracy through Facebook ads, as though the United States hasn't always and continues to interfere far more aggressively than anything the Russians were accused of doing. And in 1964, there was a coup that violently overthrew the democratically elected government and installed in its place for the next 21 years a brutal and repressive military dictatorship. And obviously, at the time, a lot of Brazilians suspected that the coup was enabled by the CIA. The problem was there was no proof of that. So even people on the American left in the United States who also thought this, you can go and read articles in Time magazine, the New York Times, the Washington Post, mocking with this contempt people who suggested that the CIA had some involvement in the Brazilian coup. And of course, in 1969 and 1970, documents were leaked demonstrating that the CIA had a direct role in helping the generals here in Brazil over engineer that coup, provided on the ground support, military power, all kinds of technological assistance. And then 10 years after that, there were declassified the documents proving it to be true. This is just one example that I happen to know best because it's in Brazil, but it's repeated itself over and over and over and over, where every single time we learn about what the CIA did 5 years, 10 years, 20 years after what they did, but because they always operate in secret, if you say, hey, look, this looks like something the CIA did, because this is what they always do, each time you get called crazy because you don't really have the evidence until several years later. And at this point, I think you're crazier if you aren't suspicious of the invisible role the CIA is playing than if you are. One great example is, you know, people have been suggesting that the CIA had been on the ground in Ukraine in February and in March because there were indicia that their Ukrainians were capable of doing things that there was no way they could have done without the help of American intelligence. And you can find the people who were suggesting that being called Kremlin propagandists and conspiracy theorists. And now just this week, the New York Times reported that the CIA, in pretty ample numbers, have been on the ground in Ukraine working with the Ukrainian military to target Russian military assets since the beginning of the war. So this is always how it works.
So you know what the exact response to this is, and I'm very curious to your answer. If everything you're saying is true, how come I haven't heard about it? If everything you're saying is true, why isn't this a bigger story?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that I've come to see, and it took me a long time to really understand the full extent of this, is if you live in a certain society, it's very easy to believe and to see the ways in which other societies over there are propagandized. Yeah. We're constantly being told the people of this country live in a closed information system. The people in that country are lied to all the time by their government.
They don't know better because Putin.
Yeah, they don't even know there's a war in Ukraine, all this, you know, this extremist stuff. And one of the things it is it's very self-flattering. You know, we get to believe that unlike those people, we live in a free society where all this information is readily available and the truth is always known and we're never lied to or misled or deceived. And the United States in many ways has as closed of an information system as anybody. And, you know, George Orwell talked about this a lot. Noam Chomsky has talked about this a lot.
Oh, yeah.
That the most effective means of repression are not the obvious kind of brute exercises of force where you just pick up dissidents and put them in prison. Everyone can see that there's pure authoritarianism. It's the more subtle kind where anybody who's a dissident is expelled from, you know, mainstream circles and from the respectable salons, and where any dissent is immediately demonized, because there you have this appearance that you're free, but in reality, there's a kind of prison being constantly constructed in your own brain that in reality makes you more subject to manipulation than if you actually could see the brute evidence of repression.
One of your favorite, I don't want to say targets, but someone you bring, whose name you bring up a lot, is Taylor Lorenz. Now,
Okay, target, sure. I'm fine with that.
I know people who know her, and I think, in my opinion, I think it's fair to say that she is not, she's a bit of an outlier, that most corporate journalists aren't as egregious and as entitled as her. You often bring her up. Can you speak to why you think she is an example of in terms of what's going wrong in American media reporting today?
You know, I think the reason I just think sometimes people are such extreme expressions of a certain pathology that they're worth studying because they're just so undisguised about who they are. And you can kind of see, it's almost like a laboratory in which you can more clearly see what are very common, dynamics that are driving lots of other people. So for one thing, she is incredibly reckless and unprofessional and inept as a journalist. She lies constantly. She gets caught making false allegations. The thing that drew my attention to her was that she had an obsession with Marc Andreessen, the Silicon Valley entrepreneur who founded Netscape.
He was just on the show 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know if you talked about Taylor with him.
Oh, yeah.
But
I sorry to interrupt you, Glenn. Mark is very professional. you know, he's a CEO, he's a you know, very successful, and the demeanor completely changed, and you could just tell he's just champing at the bit to let it out. It was very, very funny to watch his demeanor.
Yeah, change. I know, but he's very careful, but in the, yeah. Like occasionally he loses like the full control. But you know, I don't blame him, because she developed a kind of restraining order level fixation on him, and twice in 6 weeks just blatantly lied about him. One time, you know, she was monitoring Clubhouse at the time that it was very popular. She was very upset because Clubhouse was an app that allowed what she had called unfettered conversations, meaning conversations where human adults were free to express their views to one another without some institutional force censoring and controlling and moderating what it is that they were saying. This really upset her. And she would lurk in these rooms waiting to hear somebody say something naughty and then go run and report it. And the episode that first drew my attention to her was, there was a room that was discussing the Reddit GameStop episode, yep, where those guys on Reddit had basically purposely subverted hedge funds by just constantly buying the GameStop stock, driving its price way beyond what was justified as fundamentals, almost bankrupting huge hedge funds that had shorted the stock. And it was incredibly fascinating to watch. And they had like a tagline on their Reddit, which is, "We can be longer than you can be solvent," meaning we know what we're doing makes no sense. That's why we're doing it. And we can be longer than you can be solvent. And so they were discussing it in the Reddit room, and they used the word that Reddit, the Reddit subreddit group used to describe itself. And she immediately ran to Twitter and said, "Mark Andreessen just said he used the R slur." And first of all, and it wasn't him who said it. She completely misidentified who it was. But the idea that you would lurk in a room as like some kind of a hall monitor and then report someone for using a naughty word, even though the context was not that it was derogatory, they were just describing how the Redditors described themselves, indicated to me this sort of hall monitor behavior type mentality that's dominating journalism, whereby these types of journalists don't look at their function as challenging real power or the abuse of power. Like, she wasn't lurking in Clubhouse to report on antitrust violations, yeah, or labor abuses, which, of course, Mark Andreessen is somebody we should pay attention to. He has a lot of power. He's a fair target for journalistic scrutiny.
100%.
But she doesn't want to do that. She's not looking to do that. She's looking for kind of anybody who violates liberal orthodoxy and liberal norms on behalf of liberal establishment power. And so to me, what she is two things. One is, she's somebody who doesn't try and challenge or undermine or scrutinize or subvert establishment power. She's somebody who tries to serve establishment power by making us or the target of her journalism, anybody who's opposed to it. And then also, she has this obsession with self-victimization,
yeah,
where, you know, the heroes to me in journalism when I was growing up are people who risk their lives and their, yeah, liberties to take on the most powerful institutions, or people like Julian Assange, who's currently in prison for having done that, or, you know, war correspondents who put their lives at risk.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, she is constantly centering herself and whining if somebody criticizes her work as a form of harassment or bullying. And it kind of shows how journalists have taken what's supposed to be their role of being these strong, aggressive guardians of democracy who challenge power at the expense of their own self-interest, their liberty, even their lives, and they become these very fragile, petulant, whiny, entitled people who think that they should be off limit from criticism because criticism of them is something that is too unsustainable and something they shouldn't have to endure.
Yeah, I describe them as the HR department of the regime. And it really is, in many ways, outsourcing the interests of the powerful, often at the expense of the powerless. I'm sure that Libs of TikTok article didn't sit well with you, where she all of a sudden found it necessary to go to the homes of the people from some, you know, Twitter site, which was a popular Twitter site, but in all fairness, but, you know, in terms of, it was very much like, I know where you live, and I'm going to make it a point to kind of invade your space.
Yeah, and like using Jeff Bezos's money, the richest man in the world who owns the Washington Post, using his resources not to expose the secrets of the CIA or the NSA or a big Goldman Sachs or Raytheon, but using it to unmask the identity of an anonymous Twitter user whose only crime was that she has an ideology different than Taylor Lorenz's. And that's exactly what I mean is there's so many examples where in the Trump years, as we were discussing at the beginning, not just liberals, but the corporate press began viewing the agencies they're supposed to scrutinize, not as their adversaries, but as their allies. And they would instead view as their enemy ordinary citizens whose crime was having bad politics.
And another good example of this was the Hunter laptop story, where we were told over and over that 50 intelligence agents demonstrated that these all had clear marks of Russian disinformation. And when it was later admitted by the New York Times and other such agencies that it was absolutely true, there wasn't Photoshop and Hunter's taking pictures of himself and his dong. None of those intelligence officials suffered any consequences, nor will any of these outlets that, you know, cited their work will be shy about asking them again. They won't be like, oh, you were wrong I can't use you as a source because you're inaccurate. They're just going to go back to the same well. There's absolutely no pretense of objectivity or caring about the facts so much as caring about maintaining the status quo of the power elite.
Yeah, you know, for me, this is the Hunter Biden episode, though it can seem ancillary at first glance, is probably the worst journalistic scandal of the past several years, but also the most illustrative one. Because remember that it was 2 or 3 weeks before the 2020 election when the New York Post began reporting authentic documents that obviously didn't have as their public interest what Hunter Biden was doing with other consenting adults in the bedroom or the drugs he was using. The relevant part was what it revealed about the, I think, corrupt business activities of his father, the presidential frontrunner, in using his influence to convert it into business advantage for his son and for himself in places like Ukraine and China. And in order to discredit the reporting, and not just discredit it, but to get big tech to censor it, to bar you from even discussing that reporting 2 weeks or 3 weeks before the election on the most important platforms for disseminating information, the intelligence community invented an outright lie, which was that these documents were not authentic, but were instead Russian disinformation, that caused the media to suppress and malign it, that caused big tech to censor it, and that allowed Joe Biden to accuse Donald Trump of serving the Kremlin every time he raised it. And at the time, it was obvious that these documents were authentic. I staked my whole career on the authenticity of those documents because I had a lot of experience in authenticating large archives. It's what I did in the Snowden case. It's what I've done covering WikiLeaks. It's what I did in the investigation I did in Brazil that freed a former president. And all the indicia that we always use to authenticate large archives were all present. Not when the New York Times 18 months later finally admitted the documents were authentic, but at the time. And that's why I quit The Intercept when they wouldn't let me report on it, because I knew these documents were authentic. But when the evidence emerged from the sources they regard as the most authoritative, a political reporter wrote a book at the end of 2021 with independent reporting proving the key documents are real. And then the New York Times and Washington Post both recently acknowledged that they were able to confirm the authenticity of these emails. Not one media outlet, not one, that at the time reported that these documents were Russian disinformation, even acknowledged this subsequent proof.
Yeah.
Let alone accounted for why they spread that and ratified that lie, let alone retracted it. Not one. And that's because these media outlets know that they speak only to a liberal audience that doesn't just tolerate them lying on behalf of the Democratic Party, but demands they do so. These readers would be angry if they retracted that lie, even though it's a lie, and they know who it is that they're speaking for.
Let's get back to the show. One of the issues where I think it's hardest to get kind of objective data is when you have an issue of war, because on the one hand, you're going to have both parties are going to be trying to play their cards as close to their chest as possible. You know, anything that's in the media is going to be, you know, public to your opponent as well. I'm very curious to hear, and I know you could probably go on about this for hours, what is the actual state of affairs going on in Ukraine right now, as far as you know, and what do American consumers of American media, what misimpressions are we getting?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, all governments lie in general. If you don't know that, you should not be anywhere near reporting or journalism. That's right. The starting point. But they lie most egregiously and most aggressively in war, which makes sense because war is often an existential threat to these societies and these countries. And you would expect human beings to do anything, including lying as much as they have to, in order to advance their interests when they're threatened existentially. So war propaganda is always the worst. And from the beginning, what happened was there was a regime of censorship that was being built during the Trump years that got radically strengthened in the name of January 6th. Remember, not just the Hunter Biden censorship, but they destroyed Parler at the time. Yep. That Parler was the leading app because it was the home of conservatives. They banned the elected president, the sitting elected president of the United States, from every major media platform, Donald Trump. And then during COVID, that censorship regime was strengthened aggressively. I mean, no challenges permitted to the pronouncements of Dr. Fauci or the World Health Organization, no matter how many times they proved to be in error or lying. And this regime of censorship has been kind of cultivated now through multiple crises, and the war in Ukraine elevated it to a previously unseen level. European institutions, state institutions, mandated that social media companies remove Russian media from their platform so that the only available source of information to Western populations became Western news outlets that were constantly ratifying the American and NATO line, which was the pro-Ukrainian and anti-Russian line. And as a result, you know, unless you really aggressively search for it, you download a Telegram onto your phone and were able to see things that way, or you went out of your way to listen to Russian media sources, there was really no way for you to evade this propaganda. You only were hearing one side of the story. And so for the first, you know, 8 to 10 weeks of the war, all we heard was that the Ukrainians were winning, the Russians were days away from military collapse, that these feisty Ukrainians were, you know, kicking Russian ass, and we were all cheering how inspiring this was, that they were on their own figuring out just through patriotism and the union of their citizenship to be able to ward off a much more powerful military, that this was an act of pure and unprovoked aggression, and that the war started, you know, basically on February 24th when the Russians crossed over into Ukraine. Basically, everything about that narrative is false. There's been a civil war in eastern Ukraine going back to 2014 in the Donbass region between Russian-speaking separatists in Ukraine who want to be part of Russia the way Crimea did, and those who want to be loyal to Kyiv, primarily hardcore nationalists or even neo-Nazi battalions fighting these Russian-backed separatists. On top of that, the United States has, you know, been in Ukraine and involved in the internal affairs of Ukraine at least since the change of government, which many call a coup back in 2014. Remember that when Burisma, the Ukrainian energy company, wanted to pay somebody to do its bidding, they didn't pay the child or the son of a Ukrainian politician. Right. They paid Joe Biden's son $50,000 a month because it was Joe Biden who was basically governing Ukraine like a colonial overlord. And now the reality is just too stark to deny it anymore. The reality is, though, suffering a lot of losses because of the provision of very sophisticated weaponry by the United States and NATO, the Russians have been steadily advancing and steadily making progress. Their control of those regions of eastern Ukraine that Putin said he wanted to liberate and allow to be independent is essentially complete. The control over eastern Ukraine is all but consolidated. The Russians are clearly winning the war. And the reality is that the objective of the United States has become clearer and clearer, which is not to defend Ukraine or Ukrainians, but to sacrifice Ukraine and Ukrainians in order to weaken the Russians as much as possible, the way we sacrificed Syria with the same goal, the way we sacrificed Afghanistan in order to stop the Soviet Union.
The Korean War. The Korean people were the ones who suffered the most.
Exactly. And the reality is that from the beginning, Zelensky and various Ukrainian diplomats were attempting to engage in diplomacy with the Russians, knowing that it was their country that was going to be destroyed in pursuit of this geopolitical goal of weakening Russia. And they were often blocked openly by Boris Johnson, by Joe Biden, by other NATO leaders who saw an opportunity to weaken Russia for economic and political gain. And that's what this war is really about.
Someone else who you talk about frequently, and frankly, the more people talk about him, the better, is Julian Assange. Now, the big kind of lie that you see about him on social media, and I would love to hear you kind of break it down, is Julian Assange was a hacker who was working for Putin. And as a result of his hacking into government information, a lot of people got killed. So therefore, he deserves whatever he gets.
So it's so interesting because when Julian Assange first started becoming a known commodity, it was in 2010 when Chelsea Manning, who was an army private in Iraq at the time, had discovered a whole archive of information that revealed very serious war crimes by the United States government in Iraq, lies the United States government was telling its people, videos showing the virtually deliberate killing of civilians, including journalists, by American troops in Iraq. And by and large, there was a lot of support for Assange on the left because of that old leftist view that you had described at the beginning of being opposed to imperialism and militarism and these security state agencies. And there was a lot of hostility toward him on the right. Obviously, a lot of that changed in 2016 because the reporting Julian did in 2016 with WikiLeaks reflected very poorly on Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee. Those documents were completely genuine. They led to the resignation of the top five officials of the DNC, including W. Wasserman Schultz, the then chair of the Democratic National Committee, because basically they were cheating on behalf of Hillary Clinton. Obviously relevant information, but that made it so that now no longer was it just the American right angry at Julian Assange, but also liberals and the left, and he had no more support. The Obama administration wanted to prosecute Assange. They tried to do everything they could. And what they concluded was there was no way to prosecute Julian Assange without also criminalizing all journalism, because these 2010 leaks that the CIA and the US military were so angry about were ones that were published not by WikiLeaks, but by the New York Times, by The Guardian, by El País, by all of the major newspapers all over the world with whom WikiLeaks partnered. And the Obama administration, despite really wanting to put Julian Assange in prison, basically concluded that as much as we want to, there's no theory available to us that would allow us to criminalize Julian Assange without also criminalizing all of these newspapers that publish the same material and destroying a free press. The Trump administration, and not Donald Trump, but Mike Pompeo and a lot of these kind of neocons who worm their way into the Trump administration by flattering Trump and pretending that they were more populist than they really were, made it a priority to destroy WikiLeaks. And they invented a theory that was completely false, that Julian Assange did not just passively receive information from Chelsea Manning, which I presume they would acknowledge a journalist is allowed to do, that you can't be criminalized because you receive classified information from someone in the government who gives it to you, but that he actively cooperated with her, helped her cover her tracks, and that made him a part of the conspiracy. And the reason why this is such a dangerous theory, no one alleges, including the US government, that Julian Assange actually helped Chelsea Manning access these documents. She, as a member of the military, she had access to them. She sent it to Julian Assange without his even knowing who she was, let alone participating or helping her. Not even the US government claims that. All the government claims is that he talked to her about how to cover her tracks, about more information that she might be able to get him. And I can just tell you, as somebody who's a journalist who has done work like this, every single journalist in the world not only has the right, but the duty to help protect your sources and help them evade detection. Yeah. You can go right now to the New York Times, or the Washington Post, or NBC News, and they'll have unpublished pages about how, if you're a source inside the US government who wants to leak to them classified information, what you should do or avoid doing in order not to get caught. Don't use open phone lines. Don't talk about what you're doing. Use Signal, use encryption. That's all Julian tried to do, is to work with his source to help her not get caught and to help her try and get more information into the public hands that's in the public interest. If it's criminal to do that, if a journalist working with a source to help them protect themselves and to get more information into the hands of the public is a criminal, is a co-conspirator with the source by virtue of doing that, then every single journalist is going to become a criminal. Yeah. You can criminalize any kind of journalism if this theory prevails. The worst part of all of this, though, is that I don't think the Biden administration really wants to extradite Julian Assange onto American soil and allow him to stand trial. Imagine what a media circus that would be, the platform that would give Julian to be able to speak about a lot of things the U.S. government probably doesn't want him speaking about. The goal was to force him into detention. It's now essentially a decade between the asylum he was forced to get from Ecuador and the 3+ years now that he's been in a high security prison, to basically break him psychologically and physically, perhaps even to kill him, without ever having to convict him of any crime, in order to neutralize one of the most consequential and pioneering and successful and courageous journalistic operations that the West has seen in the last, you know, half century, which is WikiLeaks. And they've by and large succeeded in disappearing Julian Assange without ever having once convicted him of any crime other than a misdemeanor count of bail jumping.
Why do you think journalists spend so much more time, from my perception at least, championing the cause of Taylor Lorenz than they do championing the cause of Julian Assange?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, right? You would think that journalists just instinctively would look at Julian Assange and realize that the prosecution that the United States government is pursuing is something they ought to be vocally opposing every day of their lives, if not because they take their identity as a journalist seriously. I mean, Assange should be a hero to every journalist, given the fact that he broke more stories than virtually every one of them who hate him combined will ever break in their lifetime. But just out of self-interest, as I said, if this theory prevails, it will enable not just the U.S. government, but governments all over the world to criminalize any journalist. So you would think that corporate journalists would have a very strong interest in impeding and denouncing this prosecution, and yet they're not, in part because they're very kind of cliquish, and, you know, they only look at people who work for giant media corporations as real journalists. Yep, it's a very authoritarian way of seeing the world. And, you know, Taylor Lorenz worked for the New York Times. Now she works for, you know, the Washington Post. She grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut. She's one of them. She went to Swiss boarding school. They're the kind of, she's the kind of people that they know and identify with. Julian Assange is like this, you know, kind of weird dissident Australian who never worked in their newsrooms, and therefore they just don't identify him. They see him as kind of this person in the outgroup. But the bigger reason, I think, is psychological, which is that, you know, they're indoctrinated with the idea that as journalists, they're supposed to be doing what Julian Assange has spent his life doing, which is exposing the secrets of the most powerful institutions at great risk to themselves. That's how we defined journalism earlier. And I think that the existence of Julian Assange makes them feel enormous shame, because he's like a mirror that he holds up that they're forced to look at and realize that they could not be any further away from the kind of fantasy they have of themselves, or the brand that they disseminate about what their function is, and they resent him for it. It's like a kind of professional jealousy, but also sort of a feeling of inadequacy. And so by criminalizing him and getting to talk about him like he's trash and disappearing him, this kind of sensation that they have is alleviated.
I do want to make one little point, which is, if you go looking around for the name of that boarding school that Taylor Lorenz supposedly went to, you cannot find it. It always will literally say a Swiss boarding school, but it never says which one. And I've done more than enough time Googling around. So something's fishy there, but I guess that's kind of neither here nor there.
It's like her birthday. Good luck trying to find her actual birthday, which changes, you know, based on what day of the week it is.
If you were in America right now, one would get the impression that abortion has become illegal everywhere, that if a woman tries to get an abortion, she's going to be thrown in prison tomorrow. This is, in my opinion, pretty clearly not by accident, by design, that is the impression media outlets are giving to their audience. Do you think that this is something that, in terms of misinformation, things have gotten like that much worse? Or do you think that, you know, when we were kids, they were just lying as badly, but because we were kids and we didn't have social media, we were kind of oblivious to it?
No, I really think the lying has gotten worse.
Okay.
And I think the reason has two words: Donald Trump. I really think that for most of the people who work inside these institutions, I don't think they pretend to believe this. I think they actually believe this. They see Donald Trump not as what he is, which is kind of a reflection of the American political tradition or a symptom of the failures of American institutions. They see him as this radical deviation from the noble American history, which is why, you know, they're embracing the Bush and Cheney families, despite what they used to say about them. because they want to create this framework or see the world in through this prism where there's all these, you know, great and heroic and noble leaders, benevolent leaders. Sometimes maybe you disagreed with them. Sometimes maybe they made mistakes, but they were all good people who believed. And then suddenly Donald Trump is like a Hitler figure, like a satanic figure. You know, it has like religious overtones to them, but they believe they're engaged in this world historic conflict. And, you know, just as I was saying earlier, it makes sense for countries at war to abandon all ethical precepts and to lie because they believe, you know, often justly that they're fighting for their very survival. If you really believe that Donald Trump is a Hitler-like figure, that he, and, you know, we heard, you know, recently people starting to play with the idea that Putin is worse than Hitler, that maybe Trump is as bad as Hitler, if not worse, maybe worse than Hitler. If you really believe that Donald Trump is a white nationalist fanatic who's coming to destroy American democracy and replace it with a dictatorship of white supremacy, on some level, it almost makes sense.
Yeah.
If you're a journalist, you would just start purposely lying in order to mislead and deceive the American public to join the political project that you believe is so crucial. They have become fanatics. They're like religious zealots, and they don't operate with any constraints whatsoever. And it's everything now. Everything is catastrophized.
Yeah.
Everything is, you know, completely unrailed, like just completely detached from any sort of reality. The way they're talking about the Dobbs decision, the way they're talking about everything that's going to come after as though it's already done, that, you know, essentially gay marriage is now going to be banned and contraception is going to be banned and interracial marriage is going to be banned. When, agree with it or not, all the Dobbs decision said was that we, the nine unelected members of the Supreme Court, shouldn't be the ones deciding how abortion is regulated. You, the people, democratically should be the ones deciding that. There's just no accurate description at all to be found anywhere in mainstream discourse of what that decision was.
It's a hard prediction to make. So if you want to punt this one, that's fine. Do you expect, as a consequence of the January 6th hearings, for there to be some sort of criminal charges or a third impeachment against Donald Trump?
I think that you have to look at what the strategies are with everything they're doing with regard to Trump. So on, you know, one immediate level, that second impeachment trial never made any sense. Why would you impeach a president who's, you know, 2 weeks away from leaving, knowing that you're never going to be able to complete the trial in time for him to be impeached? And the answer was because it was Republican senators who were very worried about what Trump was going to do in the transition. They thought he might pardon Julian Assange or pardon Edward Snowden, which he came very close to doing, especially in Snowden's case. They thought it was going to declassify CIA documents, including documents pertaining to the now, 55 or 60-year-old Kennedy assassination. Why are those documents still classified? And that gave them leverage, Republican senators like Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio to say, or Mitch McConnell to say, if you do any of these things, we will convict you and you'll be barred from ever running again. I think the reason they're so obsessed with the idea of a criminal prosecution is because they're petrified, for good reason, given what a complete failure the Biden administration is, and Joe Biden in particular is, and they have no one that they have any confidence would be any better to replace Joe Biden with, that Donald Trump will get the Republican nomination and he will win again. That is what they are dying in fear over. And they don't believe in the democratic process. They don't believe in their ability to defeat Trump democratically through the process of the electoral system that the Constitution created. And so they want to render him ineligible. And they hope that the Justice Department will do that work for them. And, you know, I think for a long time, Merrick Garland was very resistant to the idea that they had any valid basis to indict Trump in connection with January 6th. The pressure on him now politically and from every corner is so enormous, which is so ironic since one of the main complaints about William Barr and the Trump Justice Department was that it was all politicized. They responded to political pressure, which was never really true. It is true, though, that they want Merrick Garland to do that. You know, for a year, Merrick Garland refused to charge anyone with sedition, and they were so angry about that, they pounded him over the head repeatedly in the media, and then finally he did it. So, you know, if you had asked me 3 months ago, I would have said there's no virtually no chance Merrick Garland will indict Trump. But I think we're now seeing the signs that Merrick Garland is susceptible to this kind of pressure and doesn't want it on his legacy that he could have prevented Trump from running in 2024 and failed to do so.
And here's another one. You feel free to punt this question. Who would you have voted for in the 2020 election if you did in fact vote?
Yeah, that's just, I don't refrain from answering that out of like an attempt to be coy or evasive or whatever. It's just that I feel like as a journalist, if I do attach myself to a particular political candidate, it just compromises my ability to speak honestly. I feel like if I declare my vote for somebody, then I have an incentive to make them more noble or make the other person less so. And so I really try to just avoid developing those kinds of preferences.
Do you think things are going to, in the medium term, because in the short term, I think there's no doubt that things are going to get worse in the States. But in the medium term, do you think, do you foresee America going in a more positive direction, or do you see it coming in a more negative direction? Are you black-pilled or are you white-pilled?
I mean, if those are my choices, I would definitely say black-pilled.
Okay.
You know, I think one of the greatest failures of the American, just sort of the American political system, the media system, was to ask itself why it is in 2016, somebody who had spent the last decade as a television host of a reality TV show, a very unpopular candidate, by the way, in 2016, was able to defeat, you know, the most formidable political machine that has been built in modern American political life, which is the Clinton machine, you know, fueled by enormous amounts of money, ruling by intimidation and fear and power. How did that happen? And why is it that underneath this incredible political talent named Barack Obama, did the Democratic Party for those 8 years, even when he was reelected, essentially collapse? And the answer is because the ideology, the prevailing ideology of both wings of each party, the establishment wings of each party, is neoliberalism that destroys the society in which it prevails. That's why Brexit won. It's why Brazil elected a figure like Jair Bolsonaro after spending two decades as more kind of a center left, center right country. It's why there have been all these radical changes taking place in country after country, because if you embrace a political ideology that is designed essentially to destroy the population's economic security, and your only response is to paramilitarize the society, to signal to that population that if even if they get to the point where they want to rebel, they're going to get crushed if they do, then I don't think it's surprising that things are going to get worse. And I don't see, you know, I mean, Trump's election was the attempt by the American people to radically and fundamentally change the ruling ideology. And because of a bunch of reasons, including the power of the establishment and his lack of discipline, he really wasn't able to do it. And I don't have a lot of hope that if he's elected again in 2024, he'll be able to. And so I see this ideology of neoliberalism and globalism that is ruining the mental health and the economic security of hundreds of millions of people at a time as getting more and more entrenched. And it's being more and more difficult to unearth it until it's uprooted. You know, I think it's hard to have anything but pessimism of the societies that it governs.
Glenn, we're running out of time. What has been your favorite part of this interview?
Just the complete ability to speak about critical issues without having to do it through the prism of these dreary and archaic left-right binaries, you know, a Republican-Democrat binaries. I feel like it's so refreshing when you're able to analyze these kind of issues without those propagandistic blinders that everybody's required to wear in the mainstream discourse.
You are welcome.
Hey, this is Adam Carolla. Let me tell you about my podcast. We do it every single day, so you can subscribe and there'll always be a fresh one waiting for you. It's about 2 hours of topical topics and news and guests and comedians and, of course, my own vitriolic take on just about everything that's going on in the world. Plus, We get a lot of really interesting, notable people who come in. We'll get politicians. We'll get tastemakers. We'll get stand-ups. We'll get authors. We'll get pundits. We'll get, I think about covers it all, celebrities as well. And we'll do some really interesting interviews with them. You can get The Adam Carolla Show wherever you download your podcasts.